We need these distributing. Can you help us, Alana? Some people may have already got one of these from last time. I don't know. So just tell Alana. If you've got it, just the same as last month's teaching. So there's two other documents. Thank you. So welcome to this weekend of reflection on the subject of suffering. Not a subject that maybe appeals to everybody, but I think there's a great reason, great meaning in studying it from the Buddhist perspective. But so we've got 10 till 5, 2 days. So if we follow the pattern of tea break at 11:15, and a 20-minute tea break, roughly speaking. And then we'll have another session after the tea break, and then lunch at 10 minutes to 1. And then lunch break until 2 o'clock, and then again two sessions in the afternoon with a tea break in between. So that's the sort of timetable. And so we're going up to 11:15 now. So first of all, I'd just like to hear a little bit from you about where you're at, you know, how long you have been studying Buddhism and so forth, just to know where you're coming from. So how about you, Stuart, could you start us off? Are you a person who's adopted the Buddhist outlook? Not clear yet, okay. Just wondered. Next to you, if we go around and from the back and then come this way. Thank you very much. Yes, same here. been that, doing that in London? Or?
Yeah.
Mm. So maybe we should go across there. A bit. Yeah. Four Noble Truths by His Holiness or by Geshe Tashi? Yeah. Okay, yeah. Yeah, well, if you've got a bit of background on the Four Noble Truths, that's very helpful for this course, definitely. Yes, may we know your name?
David. Mm-hmm. I've been studying Buddhism for about 5 years now, from a sort of academic point of view. I've been meditating quite regularly for 5 years, but I learned to meditate about 30 years ago.
Mm. Studied in the Tibetan tradition or some other tradition of Buddhism particularly?
No, a very varied listening to talks of all sorts and reading books of all sorts. I do come here fairly regularly. I've been coming here for about a couple of years for education sessions.
Mm-hmm. Great. Good. Well, you've got some good basis there then. And it's Hilana, isn't it? Yeah. Well, you were here in the last course on impermanence anyway, so that's helpful. Because in my own mind, it's like a continuation of, the study on impermanence, leading on into the study of suffering, because that's the way the text is written that we are basing our study on. So that's good to have that continuity. So I want to start off by going back onto the subject of impermanence. But suffering is a subject which obviously if you're already in a kind of a suffering sort of state, more than usual, kind of you've got personal problems or whatever, the depression and all those kind of things, and there are many, many things that can push us over the edge, and we've all been there. So this sort of subject might, make you feel worse than you're already feeling. So I don't want to let that sort of lead to any problems. So, if you have any personal issues or anything like that, anything that's really making you sort of keenly depressed or anything or whatever, then please say so or communicate to somebody in the course or somebody that in the center or me, just to tell us how you're feeling, because we don't want this sort of subject to be taken in the wrong kind of way. Buddha is teaching suffering in order to get us out of it. I hope it sounds like that should be pretty obvious to most of the people here. So it's not like drowning kittens, it's not like you're just trying to push the head under the water. But we're not trying to do that to ourselves. But we're trying to sort of pull ourselves out of extract ourselves out of any suffering we may have, you see. But that does involve you know, trying to get a good perspective, a good complete picture of what's happening, you know, what's happening in our lives. So, you know, it's very relevant to study suffering, not just sort of to try and ignore it, pretend it's not happening, or just push it into one corner and getting on with life, which is what, you know, most people, or a lot of people, might tend to do a lot of the time. So it's just a kind of a little sort of, you know, appeal to you not to go away and keep all your problems to yourself if you've got some special problems, you know. So we are trying to be to help each other here, not just to make ourselves all feel depressed and everything. So it sounds like some of you, most of you, have got some sort of basic background in Buddhism, so we don't know really to start from the beginning and kind of explain things right from square one, but try and sort of, you know, get more quickly to sort of Buddha's sort of unique kind of points about suffering, Buddha's unique points about how to, you know, take ourselves out of this realm of samsara where suffering goes on and on occurring. So if you'll just look at the Four Noble Truths, you can see the context in which suffering is talked about, you see. Buddha did talk about the truth of suffering. It is a reality. But then he also talked about, you know, what's causing our suffering. He's putting a finger on the cause, like a doctor trying to diagnose a disease. He's not just sort of talking about the symptoms. There's a, where are these symptoms coming from then, you know. And then he teaches the state of cessation, that it is possible to be completely free from suffering. So that cessation there means cessation of suffering. Nirodha. That's the Sanskrit word, isn't it? Do you know any Sanskrit? Nirodha. Cessation of suffering. I remember I was in India, you know, tootling along one of these three-wheeler scooter taxis you get in Delhi. My friend is Indian. I'm just off to see him now quite soon and have a reunion with him. And he was laughing because there's this big sign painted on the side of a building. It says Nirodha, you see. So I didn't know any Hindi or Sanskrit at the time. Don't know much now, but he's kind of, you know, half Indian, an Indian citizen. So he was laughing Nirodha. And it wasn't an advert for a Buddhist course or anything. It was like an advert for condoms. This is the name of a brand of Indian condoms at that time, 10 years ago, whenever I first went to India and met him. 20 years ago now. Nirodha was a birth control brand. Yeah, so definitely we're looking for the cessation of suffering. We want to get a good, clear view of suffering in order to bring about the cessation of it. And the cessation of it, you know, is something that also depends upon bringing about, you know, creating the causes for that cessation to come into being, for that cessation to manifest. So again, we have to, you know, follow the causes which lead to that result. And we spent some time last week, you know, discussing just cause and effect itself before we went on to the subject of impermanence. So yeah, there's all these ways of Buddha's got of bringing us to happiness. And you know, just to review main ones maybe, avoiding negative karma, you know, concentrating on doing positive karma. That means, you know, karma that helps others, doesn't hinder them. Karma that avoids bringing suffering to others. This eventually, you know, according to Buddha's teaching on karma, brings us, you know, nearer to happiness. The good deeds that we do ripen us happiness for ourselves. And the bad deeds we do is what plunges us deeper into samsara, deeper into the round of suffering. So we have to be, you know, mindful of karma in order to, you know, align our behavior with, you know, the approach to happiness, number one. Then number two is something a bit more radical than that still, is like you understand that to really be free from suffering, you have to be free of this world. So that's the samsaric world. So the world where suffering goes on and on occurring, it's called samsara in Sanskrit, isn't it? So that's this world where we go from life to life, you know, from death to death. So it's kind of got this sort of cyclic, this sort of repetitive feel to it, you know, until we can step off the round of birth and death, till we can step away from, or, you know, suspend the causes which impel us into this world, the world of transitory existence, the world of suffering existence. So it's quite a radical giving up on the world. It's the sort of talk about renunciation, don't we, at this point. So determination to forsake the world. So that's, that we have to think deeply about, are we ready to do that? Are we even got a concept of what that means? So that's Buddha's sort of path of freedom leads all the way beyond this world. So what's all that about? But that's the path he's, he himself took, when he left the palace life and left all his luxurious and promising career as a king, future king, and went off seeking the truth. And then, another way we can approach happiness is seeking the happiness of others. So this is something we don't need necessarily to have all those Buddhist sort of understandings and perspective in place. People can, well practice compassion, kindness to others, even if they're not anywhere near calling themselves Buddhists. But that's one, a great truth of the masters throughout the ages, but a very difficult truth to realize, that our happiness comes about, or our greatest happiness, or our, the most wise method of happiness is for us to, become interested in the happiness of others. Seeking your own happiness through the happiness, through working for the happiness of others. It sounds quite counterintuitive to many people, I'm sure. But what does Shantideva says? Whatever happiness within this world all comes from wanting others' happiness. Whatever suffering within this world all comes from wanting happiness for me. Putting me first is a big problem. So that's Shantideva's wise words. Yeah. So to plumb the depths of those words is quite, it's quite difficult, isn't it? But that's a third technique for approaching happiness, according to the Buddha's teachings. And then finally we have, this wisdom of emptiness, the wisdom realizing selflessness. So what is the technique, or what is the understanding, the insight that really cuts through suffering altogether? What really releases your heart from all kinds of disturbance? When you are contemplating the emptiness of all things, that sort of the ultimate nature, the ultimate way things are. This is the place where the heart is at rest. Through deep meditation on that, that is indeed the way you pass beyond the world. So, Buddha's got these, different range of methods for different people at different stages. And I think the one that we're coming in today is, more about the second than anything else, determination to forsake the world, renunciation. But we can take it at all sorts of levels, whatever we're capable of. It's not like everybody's got to wear a hair shirt and shave their head, be celibate and everything like that. We're not necessarily talking about some sort of manifest change of life like that. It doesn't necessarily amount to that. We take from it what we're ready for, what we're ready for. So it's this effort to think about suffering then is to try and give us a kick in the right direction, try and give us a boost to make our progress go where in stable happiness is to be found. So that's what we're trying to investigate. We're not trying to go deeper into dissatisfaction. So last time we talked about impermanence as one of the first steps on this path. But for those of you who weren't here for the last course last month, maybe we should just review. We didn't finish the section on impermanence. the last course was about impermanence, you see. So we didn't finish that because it's a slightly longer section than any of the other sections in the document. So we could review it in a way, just finish off the section. But for those people who weren't here last time, it might be a bit of a steep introduction. I don't know. It might be, get a bit difficult. But we'll see, shall we? And, you know, any questions you have about the general Buddhist picture, wherein the context into which all our talk fits today, you know, please feel free to ask. Certainly after lunch we can have a discussion session, for instance. You know, so don't feel you've got to keep quiet about your queries just because we are concentrating on this particular topic, you know. Do feel included so you can ask your questions. So that the text that we're basing ourselves on is this one I've been trying to translate. So that's the larger document that you've been given. And it's called The Glowing Light of Scripture and Reasoning, Lamp Illuminating the Essentials of the View, The Four Seals Which Authenticate the Buddha's Word. So the four seals were these, like four kind of distinguishing points that mark Buddha's answer to the perennial question of why is there suffering and what can we do about it. These four distinguishing, you know, features of Buddha's sort of insight or Buddha's sort of prescription on how to deal with those questions. So four seals is like, you know, the seals that the king puts on the document, authenticating it, you see. So we've discussed all this before, so I'll just pass on. The author, Genla Rinpo Ngawang Ponsok, I think he died in 1997, so he's more or less a contemporary author, but one who never left Tibet. So I don't know how many Westerners he ever met. I think Mike Murray says he met him in Dresden, and he went a lot on him. So we have some slight connection. Anyway, just to read his opening two verses. So his Namo Guru, we bow down to the Guru, of course. We bow down to the Guru who's bringing us the precious teachings. And Genla Rinpo addresses the Guru, a sphere of noble qualities grown full, beneath whose power dark defects never thrive. Sweet Lord, whose smile shines forth in helpful deeds, your moon of speech I worship with my crown. What confidence have I that I can loose the knot of the four seals on reason's path? I'll not take refuge just in scripture, though, with factual reasoning I shall analyze. So this is a kind of approach which involves meditation, involves serious kind of thinking and, you know, contemplation and you know, the inner turn. It involves sort of silent kind of practice where you sort of examining what's going on in your own mind. But definitely we are using reasoning as our means, our most reliable method to get at the truth. This is very much Genla Rinpo's approach. So just to review by saying, getting down to the point where it says, reminds us what the four seals are, I'll just read the next paragraph again.
Would the tracks separate for the audio then?
Yes.
Together, are they? Wow, maybe we should listen to that instead of me. Yeah, maybe we're broadcasting in their church. So they're sending it back again. Okay, so with regard to that, four false graspings at the pure, the pleasurable, the permanent, and at a self are responsible for the suffering of embodied beings wandering in samsara. Yeah, so when you break down the kind of ignorant attitudes that we have when we are stumbling into suffering, what do we find? Yeah, we're blaming most of it on our unskillful mental attitudes, you see. They lead to unskillful deeds and they lead to, you know, samsara, kind of, you know, emerging out of the possibilities of life. You know, we end up with this sort of samsaric world where suffering is coming again and again, birth, aging, sickness. Birth, aging, sickness, and death, what more needs to be said? So when you break down that ignorance and try and get a more kind of close look at it, then grasping at the impure to be pure, so grasping at something that is not so worthwhile, to be worth having, to be a sort of pleasant source, you know, source of pleasure when really it cannot sustain our kind of expectations, cannot quite sustain our hopes of it. And grasping at the pleasurable, grasping at, you know, what happens in samsara to contain, you know, the sort of a fulfilling pleasure, when the problem with samsara is that it keeps letting us down. Right? It has sort of flaws to it, so that it can't provide that sort of the, it isn't, according to Buddha's teachings, you know, the pleasurable, you know, the source of pleasure that we would like it to be, to turn away from it. And then grasping at what's actually impermanent to be permanent, you know, sort of clinging to things that have a power of giving happiness which they don't. One reason being is because they are impermanent. They're all bound to break down on us. They're all bound to let us down. Bound to fade away. And then the big daddy of them all, you know, the big problem maker, the root problem maker, grasping at a self, you know, grasping at something which does not have a self, to have a self or to be a self. So grasping at things to be inherently existent, grasping at things to have their own nature, when they don't have any nature like that at all. They're mere dependent arisings, merely dependent upon causes and conditions, and merely dependent even upon, you know, the mind, sort of the observer, the observed object always depends upon the observer. So it has no reality, nothing has any reality, any ability to give us happiness in and of itself, you know, by its own power. Anything that only happens in the perspective of a mind that's able to see it that way. So again, if you understand that properly, it really completely changes your expectations of what can give happiness and what gives suffering in this world. But that's not so much what we're going to talk about today. We're concentrating first on this the third point about seeing the impermanent as permanent, and then how that leads to suffering. You see, we talked about impermanence in the last course, but I avoided trying to make any connection with suffering, knowing that that's sort of, you know, coming a bit further down the line, and it's sort of a difficult subject anyway to talk about impermanence. So, but today we have to get onto some of the implications of what that means. So just to read the next paragraph, by mistaking the impermanent to be permanent, the impure to be pure, what is suffering to be happiness, and what is selfless to be a self, we in this way become attached and cling to outer and inner phenomena and accumulate various evil actions, as the effect of which we have to experience these varieties of fierce suffering for a long time. They do not arise without a cause, nor from an inappropriate cause. So, if we want definitely to be free from suffering, we must abandon the four fallacies. Therefore, we must meditate thoroughly on their antidotes, impermanence and so forth, and at least lay down whatever imprints we can. For this purpose, I have engaged in some slight analysis here. Here then there are four. Compounded things are impermanent. Contaminated phenomena are suffering. The aggregates are selfless. Nirvana is peace. So those are the four, like, you know, essential points of the Buddhist outlook on life. So those are kind of, you know, the traditional in the scriptures. It's not just Genlan Rinpo that's picking those out. Those are the traditional four. So no other teachings quite have that combination, you know. Of course we have outsider teachings, non-Buddhist teachings. But the claim is that, you know, how do any of those teachings really get to the bottom of this question of selflessness and dependent arising? Well, maybe, you know, but where are they? Sort of Buddhism's our kind of, you know, perhaps the profoundest version of that teaching that we're going to find very easily in our own times, I don't know. And then there's a question of also again, Marimba is going to claim that, you know, even subtle impermanence, that's not something that's very sort of easily found, for instance, in the teachings that he was contrasting Buddhism with, which is the old Indian teachings, you know, the other teachings that grew up in India, that's what's available to him to compare in his analysis of, you know, what's unique about Buddhism. So the outsider schools are grasping at a permanent self, you see. They're grasping at a self that is sort of separate from the aggregates. They're grasping at a self that's permanent. And even everyday objects, as we discussed, you know, like trees or pots, they also, as long as they abide, they must have some sort of permanent entity abiding there. So how can they grasp at subtle impermanence if they're insisting that things that abide in this world for a few moments have to have some sort of permanent essence in order for them to persist? So, you know, these to a certain extent then are, you know, must be sort of uncommon features of Buddha's presentation, how to gain insight into suffering and how to get rid of it. Right, so if we could jump to sort of towards
'70s and '80s, and we always used to say stuff was written in tablets of stone. I did two of his things, three of us, something else.
Yeah, it was because he did the singing.
I was just thinking, because in fact, I'm going to be going later.
Done so much.
Tricky character.
Don't jump up at the end and
knock
yourself out on that.
The reasoning which newly establishes impermanence. Okay? Now, there are three sections of that. So the first section is a bit
Would you call that wide for the start? Wide isn't that?
I suppose it depends where Toby is.
Yeah. Really short. We'll run out of just a minute. There we go. Uh-huh.
Sit them slightly closer together so you can just get...
In a strange way, after. Very strange.
Is it easy just to start off with the tight and then do the pickup later?
Did you ever meet you on there?
No, I
didn't.
But it's just getting the air question.
Did you?
I get psoriasis very badly.
Would you?
So I wouldn't have the idea of it being a conversation.
My reflection during the same detective.
Yes.
It informed his work, and I think it informed his personality.
Yes.
And his the study of it, the illness, is very much a work in progress. And I see a very good specialist in London.
Yes.
Which is amazing. I've spoken to one of my actors, and I've become do the mix between mental illness and psoriasis, which are sort of
really
underappreciated, but medically becoming now the thrust of their treatment of it.
Really?
Because the idea that your skin should be related to your mental makeup is a leap until you think about when you're embarrassed, you blush. When you're scared, you get goosebumps. And so the unit that looks after me is a unit that this woman, this amazing consultant, has built up through charitable donations, and she's got her little team, and she's sort of cherry-picked. And she's completely turned my life now. But as a result, I've always sort of been drawn to Potter because he's been on the screen so effectively with that drama, and then it obviously affected him quite profoundly.
Yes.
His attitude to women is very curious. You know, that worshipping of them and then being reviled by that very worship. Because as soon as they prove not to be mythological figures, they're disgusting and dirty and horrible, you know. And my goodness, the other people, you know themselves. Put it into his writing, which is
coming.
Can we just sort of write these? Right up inside the shoe?
Yeah.
It's impossible for us to say that's the pot today, and it wasn't. It's
different. And the leapage will weigh on them. So as it were, the paper should turn from the
Chart that physically doesn't need to point to you.
Even if it's a very high definition photograph, you know, as exact and perfect as you like, there's no change apparent to
you do it.
Do this?
Yeah, that sort of
take now. That's enough. South Bankshire, I think, and then you as well. Part of it, but he got there after because it can affect the joints. From talking very sentimentally, because he had a sentimental streak about looking outside his window on the Forest of Dean and looking at the blossom and saying, thinking he was dying, but it was the blossom, it's the blossom. And that sort of cure for, and he sees a couple of
well, it very much becomes habits of mind, isn't it? It is, fatal kind of wrong views. So
they actually did
relationships with other people. This is where gossiping and affirmance kind of really can lead you into trouble and disappointment, or you know, bereavement, or, you know, that kind of grief. Yeah. So we have to. That's what we're trying to cultivate: a sense of that everything is passing, transient. Just like the flowers of the cherry blossom that's fading on the trees right now. Everything's like that. So the more you can be aware of that, as it applies to the inner phenomena, those within and the outer phenomena, then the more you're in tune with reality, the more you are seeing things in a sort of an awakened way, and the more you will probably act better then. So before we read the going to read the main text, then I just want to look at the verses
First time.
Try to ever encapsulate the main points of the text into, you know, a very short form, so that it's maybe, you know, easier for you to meditate on if you have the main points before you. It's just a traditional, you know, Sanskrit Tibetan way of doing things. But you have a root text which has got a lot of the main points highly condensed, and then you have an explanation of those in a prose commentary. So this is my little attempt at a kind of a root text. It says chant, so we're going to have to chant it, I'm afraid. So, so let's just try these verses. Sound is impermanent because produced, as is the final moment of a flame. Produced right then, it must disintegrate. All effects in this are just the same. If flame produced the fuel, its course has ceased. These two events are simultaneous. But when fuel ceases, so must its effect. If no more fuel, then no more flame, of course. But a lamp's last moment gleams and dies. Fuel ends in flame without an interval. Between fuel's end and flames, though here there is a moment, time infinitesimal, so merely from its causes ceasing then, immediately it must also cease. No other cause required impermanence, reflecting thus seek out the road to peace. When life runs through the fingers like dry sand, all worldly hopes and fears the plans we lay, sandcastles circled by the lapping time, birth, aging, sickness, death, what more to say? The glories of this world disfigured by its claw, causal flaw, the worm within the bud. What's flung by karma from affliction sprung brings suffering assured, no lasting good. Not just that death is certain even now, remorseless degradation toward death, impermanence of gross and subtle kinds, sheer instability in every breath, continuum of similar type or not, from gross the suffering of change we know, from subtle compositional suffering, so let revulsion for samsara grow. Impermanence dissolve all fantasies of this life's comfort, wealth, prowess or power, let me determine to forsake the world, focused effort, fill the fleeting hour. Yeah, so that's the condensed version. But you can see there is quite a few things that you might find a bit difficult to follow what's actually being said, because it is so condensed. So that's just be patient with that. You know, if you weren't here for last month's course, then it'll be even more difficult. So as I say, if you're trying to think about impermanence and square one right now, it could be a bit of a deep dive in. But maybe we can follow, so it's worth trying. And the people who've been studying a bit with me, you know, they can help you talk to them and have discussions about this. But ideally, we'd like to sort of, you know, start off before our meditations on the suffering itself to, you know, see how impermanence leads us there. Because this is, you know, Genda Rinpa's idea, you see. Gross suffering we can all understand, you know, gross suffering like broken legs and
and you know, kind of collapsing buildings, lots of people buried underneath, and you know, new diseases coming around, carrying people away and so forth. You know, we can all see this happening, but to really, you know, get right under the skin of samsara, or see where it's all coming from, you've got to get down to the level of subtle suffering. And to understand subtle suffering, you've got to understand subtle impermanence. So that's what Genlenba's sort of, you know, trying to lead us to think about, subtle impermanence. So, as I said, we need a reasoning to be able to do that. And the reasoning is here where we present our own system, considering the subject sound. It is impermanent because it's a product. For instance, just like a butter lamp about to go out. So that's it. That's what we're going to have to meditate for. All the rest is just window dressing or explanation. That's the kind of the key issue. You know how to meditate on that. Of course, then, you have to have a quotation from a great text, then. You know, you have to show that what you're talking about is from, you know, if not from the Buddha's lips, at least from the lips of great master. So immediately in this context, you quote Chandrakirti's commentary, Dharmakirti's commentary on valid cognition. But I haven't translated that yet. I've got a good idea what it means now. I went to Paris a fortnight ago and met my friend there, and we discussed this, and you know, some sort of, he's the teacher in the Paris Centre, an old classmate of mine, with whom I studied this Dharmakirti text. So he's given me some help on that, but I haven't had time to try and put it into the text yet. So anyway, there's somewhere in Dharmakirti he's explaining this is how you meditate on subtle impermanence in just the way that's been recommended. So, ideally, you know, we get down to meditating on ourselves as being impermanent. You know, this is maybe the main subject, but there's some reason for which you know, there are other subjects that might be more helpful to meditate on in the beginning. Not necessarily like, you know, sounds much easier to meditate on than yourself when you are talking about impermanence. It's not like, you know, because if you're meditating in your own mind, you can see it is very changing completely all the time, you know. When you meditate on your breath, very much you get a sense of nothing ever stays the same, does it? So that's a great start, you know. So in a way that you can see sort of very rapid change going on in your own mind or body. So that's, you can get some sort of strong sense of impermanence when you take the time to do that sort of in your turn, for sure. But there's something about sound and the last moment of the butter lamp, last moment of the flame that's about to go out, that also have their own new sort of special characteristics which make them useful, you know, as good sort of, you know, examples for meditating on impermanence about. So you can you use those subjects in your reasoning. So anybody got any questions so far? Am I going too fast, or you've got some things bothering you? Right. So when you get down to meditating on your reasoning, you've got to understand a little bit of how reasoning works. But we're all, you know, we're all kind of able to reason from a young age, actually. It's just the formal method of doing it is that it just needs to be brought to consciousness. But our actual, you know, people who've never been to school, they still know how to, you know, think about what time it is to plant their seeds in the ground, you know, how much water they're going to need, you know, where they're going to get, you know, there's lots of reasons involved even in a, you know, just being a peasant farmer in a village in Tibet. So it's not something that's, you know, we should be afraid of and say, oh, that's too difficult for me, I'm just an academic. Don't need to think of it like that. So, when you say to yourself that sound is impermanent because it's a product, okay, so then you're going from something which is hopefully like a little bit more obvious, that sound is a product, sound is produced, and from there you're going to the more hidden, the more difficult to understand feature of sound, which is that it's impermanent. So that's the one that you need to get at with reasoning, the subtle level of impermanence, not the gross level. So that's one you're going to have to sort of, break through to through the power of reasoning. So you're going like from the manifest thing, the fact that it's produced, to the hidden thing, the more obscure thing, that it's impermanent. So first of all, you should think to yourself, well, sound, is it produced or not? Is sound a product? So is sound produced? What's it produced from, though, then? Sound is produced from sound, is it? Yeah, well, maybe sound is vibration. So what's sound produced from? Yes, sound's produced from causes. When it's a product, it means it's produced. When it's produced, it means it's produced from causes. Created from causes. Yeah, that's just the meaning of the words here. Or you can say sound is produced because it's a compounded thing. It's just the same reason, really. It's produced because it's compounded out of causes and conditions. So that's where it's coming from. So that's, first of all, you have to get a good idea of that, which we tried to last month. You know, how all the things of this world, that including ourselves, our bodies, our minds, all out of phenomena of, that type, the thing type of phenomena, they're all produced from causes and conditions. Not just from one cause or one condition, but a whole mass of, almost an uncountable number of causes must come to produce any one phenomenon. If you go back in time to discover how many causes preceded the immediate cause, that actually produced you, of course your mother and father produced your body, but then your grandfather and your great-grandfather, your great-grandmother and great-great-grandmother, so how far do you go back? Well, it's hard to say there's any limit, isn't it? So infinite number of causes coming together to produce one thing. But anyway, stop there, because it's but we can often see that, can't we? We can see the man blowing the trumpet. We can see the wind blowing through the leaves, rustling the leaves of the trees. We can't see the wind, but we can see what's happening. And then the sound comes. We can see the wave hitting the beach, and then you get the sound of the water. So we can see sound being produced, or we see it. That's probably the wrong word to use as it is eye consciousness, but we're very aware, easily aware, that sound is a produced phenomenon. And for that matter, the last night of the buffalo. Right? So then we have to be, once we're convinced, it has to be an ascertainment, a proper realization that sound is a product. So then you have to be confident, and you have to ascertain that, and if it is a product, it's got to be impermanent. So you've got to have a confidence that there's a complete link there, haven't you? That anything that's produced has to be impermanent. So how do you gain conviction in that? So it's like, if it is a product, then by nature, by necessity, it must also be impermanent. So you're sort of forcing your mind, from the obvious characteristic to the more kind of one that sort of escapes our eye consciousness and our ear consciousness. It's not quite so clear that things are so impermanent. So as we're sort of pushing our mind to realize that. So it involves knowing that if it is a product, it is necessarily impermanent. So that's what we call the pervasion. If it is a product, it is pervaded by being impermanent. That's a word that's coming from the sort of Tibetan way of describing things in their philosophy texts. I think in English philosophy they might talk about entailment. Entailment, So if smoke exists, then it entails that the fire must exist. So because you can't have smoke without fire. So if there's smoke, then there must be some fire causing it. So the presence of smoke entails existence of fire. But in Tibetan, we say pervade. if there is smoke, it pervades, it is pervaded, there's a pervasion that fire also exists.
Are you confident about that? If there is smoke, there's necessarily fire? We all believe it as a kind of a folk wisdom, don't we? So we're all pretty sure about that one. And if the smoke was naturally fire? Yeah, well, inside the smoke we've seen there's some fire then. What kind of smoke are you talking about? I don't know. Smoke machine. Yeah, so that's something that we probably come to that conclusion. If there is smoke, there's necessarily fire. Have we or not, you know, that's up to you to say. To the point where, you know, if we walk up the mountain pass and we see the smoke rising, column of smoke rising from the top of the pass, we say, oh, look, there's somebody who lit a fire out up there. If we go up there, we maybe can get warm, there's a fire burning. We get there and maybe able to sort of light a cigarette or something. Really warm, you know? So from the sign of the smoke, you know there's fire there. Okay, so, but the fire's hidden, right? In this case, the fire's hidden. You can't see the fire. You can only see the sign of the smoke. So again, we're going from the obvious to the hidden phenomenon. See? Isn't that what we try to do? And we do it very successfully. How do we know that if the smoke is necessarily fire? Experience, yeah. We've somehow made the connection that one necessitates the other. It's in the very nature of smoke that it must come from fire. But it's tricky, and I have a lot of thought. How do we actually get to that point? Do we're actually certain? Because there's so many different smokes, so many different fires. Do we have to go through all, see all the smoke in the world and check that it all comes from fire? You know, we don't have to do that. That would be impossible, you know, unless we were Buddha. But how could we even see all the smoke in the world? So, you know, that's a lot of interesting, you know, the debates go on there about how you actually become established at certainty. But you can say, well, you go to the smoky kitchen. Now, that's the other Tibetan example. You go to the smoky kitchen, like the monastic kitchen where they're boiling up the tea for all the monks sitting in the prayer hall. You know, so there's huge logs of wood under these big kind of tea, tea pans. You're going to have to drown a man, you know, when there's a big assembly of monks, like in the Munlam in Lhasa. You know how the Munlam, this prayer festival in Lhasa, and all the monks, all the monasteries used to come before 1959, and so they have these huge pans of tea, huge like vats just full of this butter tea. And you know, huge logs of wood underneath. I've been in India, they certainly use wood, you know, big huge pieces of wood, like. And the kitchen is just full of smoke. It's very obvious that the smoke's coming from the wood, right, the fire, so you get the picture, right? So that's how you form your conclusion that if the smoke is naturally fire, from experience. But this is the times of the 13th Dalai Lama, they said, and my friend was telling me, and at one point one of these cooks was stirring this huge, you know, vat of butter tea, and he fell in, and he drowned or scalded to death in the tea. So, but, you know, the question, all the monks are sitting there waiting for the tea, you know, they've been chanting for hours, so they're desperate for the tea. But, you know, this man has fallen into the tea and drowned, what shall we do? So they went to ask the 13th Dalai Lama, you know, what should we do, you know, this has happened. You know, do we have to pour all the tea away, you know? And so he says, no, you fish the man out, and serve the tea. I'll pray for the man and make sure the monks get the tea, otherwise there might be a riot. You know? So Dalai Lama prayed for the man. So that, and then you see, so what you need is the obvious place where it's clear that if there's smoke, there's necessarily fire. You can form your understanding that there's this sort of inviolable relationship, that if there's smoke, there must come from fire. So you need the place where it's clear, like in the kitchen, and then when it's not so clear up on the hill, then you can go from one to the other. This is just like this one. So if this one's got fire,
divide the smoke, then that one must be the same. So the place where impermanence is a little bit more obvious then is on the butter lamp, the last moment of the butter lamp, where the flame is just going out. Because when the flame goes out, you go from light to darkness. So you've got, it's very obvious, isn't it? One moment you've got light, the next moment you've got dark. So that, sort of the impermanence of the last moment of the butter lamp is obvious, because it just goes out. Yeah? And you can see that the flame is like flickering, it's like, you know, just going like this. And you can see that there's no more butter, no more fuel left in the reservoir of fuel. Like the fuel's dried out. Like it's the last moment of butter. The fuel is going up the wick, isn't it? So you know that it's going to go out. So the impermanence is you know before it happened. Impermanence isn't just observing that it is changing all the time. Impermanence is knowing that it's going to change. It's like seeing that it will change before it happens. That's some sort of point that they make. So it's not just observing the ruffling waves of the sea, like just you're observing something that's changing all the time, that's fine. But the impermanence is knowledge that it is going to happen. Somehow that's sort of the proper understanding of impermanence. So, you meditate on the last moment of the butter lamp then. See it going out, you can see, oh yeah, no more fuel, no more flame. And the cause is finished. The effect must disappear. Isn't that true? Why does the flame go out? Because there's no more fuel. I mean, if we have wind coming in, you know, the flame is very unstable, like our own lives. You know, our own lives can be cut off before the karma, you know. We might have a karma to be born and live for 100 years. You know, we might have a really strong karma bringing us into this life. But then another very strong karma can come along, can't it? Before our reservoir of vitality is you know, exhausted, some heavy karma comes and chops a big hole in it, and all our life force drains away, and we're dead, you know. Even though the first karma had the karma to project us into a life of 100 years long, you know, some other heavy karma comes up, negative karma comes up, you know, interrupts that. So we die when we're 30 or 35 at any time. So the butter lamp is like that. You know, the wind could blow it out at any time. But here we're looking at, you know, the last moment of fuel gives rise to the last moment of flame. And then, you know, when the fuel's finished, then next moment, the flame goes out. Now, isn't that the nature of all causes? That's the point they're making, you see. So aren't all causes like that? As soon as they've produced what they can produce, what they produce, then that goes away, that falls away. So nothing that's ever produced is ever produced more than, you know, the time it takes to, you know, as soon as it's produced, it disappears. So in that verse, we're talking about this moment, time infinitesimal. The fuel ends and the flame begins, but as soon as the flame begins, that means that the fuel ceased, and if the fuel has ceased, then the flame must also cease. If there's no more cause, then there's no more effect. So I'm talking very roughly because, you know, we don't have time to... I want to do a bit of meditation here. We're almost up to tea break. Oh, my dear. Okay, well, 5 minutes of meditation. All right. I haven't explained the whole thing, but what can we do? So you're going to meditate on that the last moment of the butter lamp then. A sense of impermanence derived from the last moment of the butter lamp. Because that's the easy place to see impermanence. And then we can apply it to the more harder place like self or pot. So just trying to see if it's produced, it's necessarily impermanent in the sense. Completely impermanent. Right from the very point that it's been produced, it's disintegrating. So nothing ever lasts, even for an infinitesimal amount of time, without changing. So let's just take a few breaths, just Meditate on the breathing for a moment. Without thinking about anything, just relax the mind and go into that place of stillness. Just balancing and calming the mind. Meditating on the breath. Just a minute to focus on the Buddha and the Guru's kind blessings, the great beings that realize these truths which we're trying to understand. And they're very eager, but we should always have these liberating insights ourselves. So they're very delighted when we try to think this way, try to meditate this way. So the blessings are radiating outwards. We just feel the power of their inspiration. Now just focus on, try to picture to ourselves a candle or a butter lamp that's just about to go out. So the butter lamp is quite, the wick is usually fixed in the bottom of the cup, so the wick doesn't usually fall over, not like a candle might. So it usually remains upright. So only when the bottom of the cup of the butter lamp becomes quite dry, sort of as the last bit of oil or melted butter drains down to the wick, and then it starts to travel up the wick. There's some kind of capillary action or something where somehow the wick gets the butter gets drawn up the wick. The wick has become much reduced, blackened. So there's one more drop of fuel, one more little tiny supply of fuel. So the lamp, the light is shrinking, the flame is shrinking or flickering. And then, of course, the flame goes out, so that's light to darkness. if the effect begins, that means the cause has ceased. They're always sequential. So if the flame is produced, then its cause has ceased. You know, the fuel that caused it has ceased. So we're talking about moment by moment here. So moment, you know, any moment of fuel, any moment of flame. So that moment of flame is produced from, you know, this moment of fuel. So as soon as that moment of flame comes into existence, this moment of fuel goes out of existence. Yeah, because the fuel gives up its entity into the flame, doesn't it? So the entity of the flame, of the fuel, is finished, destroyed, and from it, you know, the flame arises. So they're exactly sort of sequential. End of fuel, and immediately, without any gap, beginning of the flame that is its effect. So it's like a simultaneous, like the end of the fuel and the beginning of the flame. There's no gap. So that's what I mean, simultaneous. The end of the fuel is simultaneous with the beginning of the flame in any moment. That's number one. Now number two, you can say, when the fuel ceases, so must its effect. No more fuel, no more flame. And no more oxygen, but no more flame. You put a jam jar over the flame. So no more cause. If the causal collection isn't assembled, the effect cannot arise. So if when there's no more fuel, then in the next moment, no more flame. So that's why I say, fuel ends in flame. So then there's no gap there. There's no, you know, the fuel ending of the fuel, the beginning of the flame. They're just simultaneous, no interval. But then we say that between the end of the fuel and the end of the flame, then there's this infinitesimal moment. The fuel bursts into flame, you know, but as soon as there's no more fuel, then there's no more flame. So in the next moment, the flame goes out because there's no more fuel to continue it. It's the last moment of the fuel. And if you want a new moment of flame, then you have to have a new moment of fuel. So every moment of flame is coming from a new moment of fuel. So you see how the flame must be just completely transient, completely impermanent. It's like a new moment of flame, and the flame arises newly in every moment. So there's a good thing to meditate on. I just focus on the impermanence of the whole process. you, we'll just stop there. Send out the merit towards understanding these difficult topics. May there be enlightenment dawn. All sentient beings' minds. So there's all the positive outcome from our effort. Educate the merit like that. So then we should have a cup of tea. Mindful of impermanence, we'll go for a cup of tea.
Let's say 20 minutes till 20 to 11. 20 to 12, sorry.